Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 9 a.m. February 5th, 2009. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson,
Chairman, good morning.
Senator Elton, Senator Huggins, and Senator Thomas.
Morning.
Today we're going to take a look at Department of Revenue with an update on the committee of some revenue numbers. We'll also have a brief discussion over some little broader ranging issues as we roll into it that are applicable to the Department of Revenue. The department released the update in the 09 revenue projections on Tuesday of this week, and we want to hear about those changes and kind of what their thoughts are coming at us as we roll into this budget cycle. And also we'll probably have some discussion over the 09 budget that we had on the table yesterday and those changes. But with us today is Commissioner Galvin, who's been here many times, and he is the commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And I think he's coming tomorrow. Is it tomorrow or the next day? We've got coming up for CBR and a few other issues.
Yes, Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett, who's in charge of the Treasury, will be here to talk about the various funds tomorrow. Okay. Not going to be available by phone. I'll be back up in Anchorage.
Okay. If you can then identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and we would like you to be on the phone, of course, when those issues come up.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With me online is Sherry Nienhuis, who is the acting chief economist, and she'll be the one giving the revenue forecast overview. I believe joining me shortly will be Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett, who is responsible for the Treasury side of the department. And as the chairman indicated, we're going to be providing you with an overview of the revenue forecasting process, walk you through the actual steps, the mechanics of how we go about it this year, given the volatility of the oil price market and its impact on our revenue forecast. We feel that there's particular need to talk about how we do our forecasting so that you can kind of see behind the veil and get a sense of your own comfort level in terms of how we go about doing our business. And she'll talk about both the process leading up to the official fall forecast that was released in December, and then the methodology that was used to derive the interim 2009, and then Mr. Chairman, we'll talk a little bit of preview about how we're going about looking at the interim 2010 forecast that will be coming up in a week or two this month. So Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll turn it over to Sherry. Sherry, are you online?
Ms. Nienhuis, are you online? Can you pick us up?
Yes, I'm here.
You have a presentation for us. I guess you're going to be the speaker and the commissioner's going to run the page machine?
Yes, that's correct.
If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then we'll walk through this and I'll try to help the commissioner keep the pages on track as we walk through it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, my name is Sherry Nienhuis. I'm the acting chief economist with the Department of Revenue. And for today's presentation, we wanted to go through a couple things. Number one, the events that led up to our fall 2008 forecast, and then some of the updates that we made with our January 2009 forecast that was just released this week. So it's an overview of a number of things, starting with a little bit about how we forecast oil revenues, and then a little bit about production and the various inputs that we have to consider in order to prepare our revenue forecast. So on the first slide, we've got three forecast variables that we have to consider when we forecast both royalty and production tax, those being production levels and price and cost, or cost can also be seen as investment. And up until the passage of the PPT, the only two variables we had to really kind of worry about were production and price, because costs were not a, a part of that calculation for the tax. But now with the net profits tax that was initially passed with PPT and now is part of ACES, we also have to forecast what we believe costs are going to be. And in addition to costs, which sometimes are referred to as operating costs, we also have to try and determine what we believe the level of investment is going to be. Investment being sometimes capital expenditures in projects that are coming online. So, you know, there's three variables now that we have to consider when we forecast our production tax revenues. So moving on to the next slide, how do these variables interact with each other? Well, they interact with each other a lot, actually. And starting at the top, you have the economic fundamentals of supply and demand. And supply and demand affects a lot of things, including price, as we've seen. And so price has a relationship to both supply and demand, and that is one of our inputs for our production tax forecast. And then price also affects production. If price is high, production might actually go up because price drives investment decisions, which also drives production levels. Price also affects cost and investment. On the same lines as what I just said about production, if the price is high, there's a good chance that you'll have, number one, more investment, and that may not be seen in production immediately, but it could be seen in production 5 to 10 years from now. And then also you have costs that are affected by price, because what we've seen in the past couple of years is that the costs actually of producing petroleum have gone up, merely because price of oil has driven the cost of a lot of things that go into producing oil up as well. So all these variables interact with each other, and you can't really take one out and not consider the other. So we have to consider all these things when we make our production tax forecast, and actually when we do our royalty forecast as well. Moving on to the next slide, I'm going to take each of these pieces one by one. First of all, we have the production piece. The next slide shows us that, this is the famous mountain slide that we show a lot of times. We do that because we want everybody to understand that, yes, we are in a period of declining oil production, and we have been for some time. We reached our peak of about 2 million barrels back in the late 80s, and we have been on a decline since. And if you look at the history from the initial peak and then where it started to decline, you'll see that that was a really rapid decline. And then we have a line where it says the difference between history and forecast. And the forecast is for a little lesser decline. And what you see there are layers of additional fields that have either come online or we believe are going to come online. And not necessarily that they're fields that come online, but also an additional development in those fields. So looking forward, we're still obviously in a decline situation, but it's leveling off a little over the history of what we've had in the past.
Ms. Niehaus, could I stop you there just for a minute while we have this screen on the, or the slide on the screen? Are these oil fields fairly reflective of what we'd see in most oil basins around the world when you open them up? You run production for 20 or 30 years. Is this a normal curve to see a big spike in production early on and then a tapering off rather rapidly into the future?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could answer that question, but if our production engineer is online, he might be able to answer it better than I could. Is Dudley Platt online?
Mr. Platt, are you online?
Ms. Hello, this is Dudley Platt.
Yes, did you hear the question, Mr. Platt?
Sure did. Yeah, I did. Good morning, committee members, Commissioner, and Sherry, hi. I think that to the extent that you don't have a lot of surplus capacity to produce, like they might in OPEC nations, that as you allow the fields to go unconstrained, that's very typical of what individual oil fields and basin-wide production areas would exhibit. Very typical. Typically, it's a rise up to a peak production that stays level, then it declines, usually irreversibly, in a hyperbolic faction, which means that it's not a constant decline rate. The decline rate softens over time, and industry refers to that as turning the corner, where you get a little bend and it goes kind of flat. And I believe we've turned the corner. Not without a lot of capital investment, mind you, but we've turned the corner.
So that maybe briefly explain to us, if you could, and the people at home, you know, why we see these type of production graphs.
Going to try to provide the most simplest answer I can to a very complex question. Furbay and Kaparik and Alpine fields, the big fields that are driving most of our production now, are very complex. It's just not like filling a bucket, poking a hole in it, and letting it drain out. Reservoir engineers and optimization engineers go through a lot of science and engineering to figure out how to get the most of the oil out of the ground. Keep in mind, worldwide, out of all the oil in the world that's ever been known to exist, right now we're only planning on getting about 35% of it out of the ground. You can implement enhanced oil recovery techniques to take that average of 35% and move it well beyond that. The North Slope operators at Prudhoe Bay will get two-thirds of the oil out of the ground. That's really good news. It still suggests that there's still one-third of the target left. Enhanced oil recovery, miscible injection projects, pumping low salinity water flood into the reservoirs, one day taking surplus CO2 from major gas sales and re-injecting it into both a sequestration project and a further enhanced oil recovery process will get more oil out of the ground. How that manifests itself is once you come off peak production, where you make increasing amounts of water with the oil. Water's not good unless you need to re-inject it to get more oil out of the ground. Once you start making more water, then you have to resort to these other techniques. And they do that feverishly. They pump a lot of money, and it does take money to bend that curve that Sherry's showing on the screen right now. Also, there's a component that Mother Nature just kind of acts on its own that's going to bend that curve just a little bit. So it's very typical to see that shape of a curve. If you go to our own Cook Inlet Basin, it'll exhibit exactly that same shape with the 15 or so oil fields down there. It looks exactly the same. A ramp up to a plateau production. You keep the plateau production constant for a few years, then it drops off very rapidly. And then, after about 80% of the oil was recovered, you see it kind of turn in the corner, kind of going hyperbolic, flattening out. Looking at production today, is about 14,000 barrels a day. And as long as they can keep the platforms going economically, it'll decline at a very, very, very low production. But to answer the question, very typical shape.
From a pump perspective, from a treasury perspective, isn't there an interest in a rapid return of the capital expense to open up these oil basins? And there's a time value of money question here. That the industry wants to maximize its production as quickly as it can, and it helps shape this type of a curve.
Yeah, of course that's true.
Thank you. Senator Huggins and then Commissioner Galvin.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Charlie Huggins. I'm sorry, I missed your name. Could you help me out one time, please?
Mr. Dudley Platt from
Dudley
the
Black.
Yeah, Property Contractor Tax Division, Department of Revenue.
Yeah, Mr. Black, Charlie Huggins here at Wasilla. I noticed you have Point Thompson on your chart. Could you just give us the parameters and how you plotted Point Thompson?
Senator Huggins, I certainly can. And that's been a sensitive issue for a while. Essentially, I forecast for purposes of cash flow. I don't forecast anything that doesn't exist, and I try to get the timing right. What I don't want to do is suggest that something's going to happen sooner than it really is, so when you take the 70,000 barrels a day we're anticipating out of Point Thompson, you don't want to say it's going to hit in 2014 if you think it's going to hit once major gas sales happens. That said, Point Thompson can be developed two ways. One is what I'll refer to as the initial way we thought it was going to be developed, as a gas cycling project. You take the 8 trillion cubic feet of gas, you build very expensive compressors to overcome very high reservoir pressures, 10,000 PSI plus, and build a pipeline probably up to Badami now to run the liquids that you get out of that, gas. The expense to do that was so high, and with the advent of the North Slope gas commercialization issues, there then was a second alternative, and that was let's not reinject it. Let's produce a little bit of the gas first, waiting for the gas to be commercialized. And that's what I'll call the latest Exxon proposal. Where in 2014, for about a $1.3 billion capital investment, they'll put whatever infrastructure is necessary in place to produce about 200 million cubic feet a day and about 10,000 barrels a day of condensates, liquid condensates, valuable condensates that come with that gas. So now, as the production forecaster, I got to figure out which is the right answer. Of course, the first thing I do is I contact our colleagues at the Department of Natural Resources and try to get the best possible way forward. Now, I don't want to get into any details because it's very sensitive. And so I've always said, look, I can't guess what a court's going to say. What I do know that if you assume that it's a major gas sale-driven project, not going to happen until you get major gas sales, I assume 10 years down the road. That would make it fiscal year 2019. That's what I'm using right now. In 2019, the plots that you're looking at on the screen there should show a little bump up.
Mr. Platt, I know it's rather difficult when you're so far away on the telephone, but let me do a little quick follow-up. If we backed up 10 years, looked at 1998, where would we see Point Thompson on your chart?
Probably in 1998, somewhere between 7 and 8 years out.
Okay, so it would be pretty much where we are today. It would be producing revenue for the Treasury.
And of course, that was intended by the then operator to the Department of Natural Resources.
All right. Okay. Commissioner Galvin, you had a question or response. It might have been back a little bit here in the schedule, but
yeah, just wanted to clarify what Mr. Platt was describing with regard to the production profile was related to individual fields, and that you would see within a field that production profile with the ramp up, the plateau, the drop off, and then turn the corner. What you see in the slide here is the layering of multiple fields beginning their individual profiles at different times. And so what you would need to do is, in sort of imagining how that translates on this slide, is you'll notice the width of those bands of revenue coming in or production coming in from those fields kind of expands and then contracts and levels off. And that's the reflection of what Mr. Platt described, reflected on individual fields. And then as we layer them, we end up with a more stable source, because we've got different fields coming on, as opposed to the individual. If you just take the Prudhoe Bay main field, what you see is that dramatic drop just in that big brown area being mitigated by the additional fields coming on over time.
Senator Elton.
Thank you. Does the production in the out years, is that predicated on the removal of gas? For example, if we ship gas, does production in the out years, are you assuming that it would be a little bit less than if we don't ship gas?
Dudley, do you want to answer that one?
Yes. right now the forecast for Point Thompson and its satellite production of 30,000 barrels a day, by the way, is premised on a scenario that more closely resembles a major gas project. So with that said, you got to ask yourself, where are you going to get the gas? Point Thompson, 8 trillion cubic feet. There's some gas in NPRA. There's gases in other fields on the north slope other than Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay is going to be needed. If you take gas out of Prudhoe Bay right now to tune of 4.5 BCF a day, you're going to get less oil production. The companies are mitigating that now in a process pumping additional water into the gas cap to keep the pressure up. Pressure is what keeps oil production going. If you take the gas out of the gas cap, you're going to drop the pressure. Lower pressure means lower ultimate recovery, lower production. So if they can find other ways to keep the reservoir pressure up, and they're doing that now, that'll help mitigate that that concern. The AOGCC, I believe, has been tasked with figuring that out. It's not an easy job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead and continue, Mr. Commissioner.
Okay, so Sherry, we're back to you. Are you done with this slide?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Ms. Niehaus, I've got one quick follow-up. Maybe it's best for the commissioner. Is it reasonable for the public of the state of Alaska to expect Prudhoe Bay and or other oil fields to produce 2 million barrels a day? There's always comments in the past that we used to produce 2 million, now we're substantially less. Should they expect us to go back to 2 million?
No, that physically it's not possible. The issue that we have is that Prudhoe Bay, at least as far as we know, is a one-shot deal. We don't have another Prudhoe Bay sitting up there that we know of. And so we have passed that time. The issue that we have is, as we move forward with the development of smaller fields, are we going to be able to sustain our current production or even increase it strictly by the aggregate of multiple smaller fields? And that's the profile that we anticipate being the future of the North Slope oil production.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does this chart take into consideration the heavy oil? Because there's 20 billion barrels of that laying around just in Prudhoe itself. Is this chart, obviously I would think that it would, but I guess I want to make sure that that's a consideration.
So, Dudley, do you want to describe how you've incorporated the potential of heavy oil into your forecast?
You bet. The 20 billion barrels, if you call that from Shreve Bluff, West Sac, and Ugnew, it includes nothing from Ugnew. BP's testing new technologies for Ugnew. ConocoPhillips is testing new technologies. I've put zero production from the 20 billion barrels of Ugnew oil in place. I'm not counting on any of that. Requires some technological advancements. Secondly, West Sac. West Sac's making about 15 to 16,000 barrels a day right now. It's been an underperformer. The operator ConocoPhillips is doing their best to try to encourage more oil out of West Sac. It's a challenging project, and because of that, and after discussions with a lot of folks that really know what they're talking about for the spring forecast, I've delayed West Sac heavy oil production. I think out of the 5 to 50 billion barrels of West Sac oil in place, I'm recovering only 400 million barrels tops. So there's a lot of opportunity. That's a very, very low percentage, a lot of opportunity.
So, Mr. Chair, I think the short answer is that we take a very conservative approach towards projecting heavy oil recovery because technically we're not there yet in terms of the amount of potential that exists. The potential is clearly there, but we have to get past some technical hurdles, and until we do, we're not including it into our forecast.
Just one short follow-up then. With that thought in mind, obviously, two-thirds of the oil in those particular fields still left in the form of heavy oil. When we then discuss going forward and revenue to the state, would we not want to have some kind of emphasis on maybe in some form of encouraging the oil industry to pursue the technology for that and or even investing ourselves in that potential because of the obvious potential for future revenue?
And Senator Thomas, through the chair, we'd be happy to talk to you about how the current production tax system encourages heavy oil development. We believe that the structure that we have in place does do that. It does encourage investment in those areas because of its impact on the tax obligations associated with the lighter, more profitable oil.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead and continue, Ms. Niehaus.
Okay, so the next slide then shows just a snapshot of the 2008, actually 2009, forward to 2030. It kind of lops off the future from that previous graph and lays it out in a larger fashion, kind of showing what oil is from currently producing projects and that, and then what oil we expect from new projects. So this is just the previous forecast magnified. Just something I will point out that Pat said, you know, our net profits tax does encourage investment. That is something that we made sure that we tried to have in our tax program. So, you know, all these projects that we're showing coming online are going to take investment. And what you'll typically see is the investment that occurs several years before the oil even comes online. So when we see a trend of increasing capital costs, we believe overall that's maybe a good thing because, you know, we like to think that that is going to go towards increasing production in the future. So this slide just basically highlights the fields that we think are coming online and also within fields that are online, what kind of increasing development we expect there.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
No, I'm sorry.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next forecast variable. So if anybody has any production questions, maybe now would be a time to ask them.
Yeah, I think maybe what we'll do, Ms. Niehaus, is go ahead and talk through your slide, and when you're ready, just pause when you're ready to go to the next slide, and I'll check the members of the committee, and if they have a question, I'll stop you, and we'll come in with questions.
Okay, sounds good. So then our next slide shows that the second of our forecast variables, and that is price, and we all know how important price is to our revenue forecast. And typically, moving on to the next slide, what we do when we try to forecast price is we hold what we call an oil price Delphi session. It is a session where we get all the state economists and some of the other state agency stakeholders in a room together. We try and do it twice a year. We've kind of, at least last year we did just once a year, but it's usually in the fall. We get together, we try and get guest speakers in to give us their views on where they think oil prices are heading, and that includes anything that has to do with oil price, supply, demand, all kinds of geopolitical stuff, you know, value of the dollar, how all that impacts the oil price. And I'll talk a little bit more about the oil price Delphi in a little bit. But that is the very first event on our forecasting timeline. But our forecasting timeline is a process. It's not just something that happens, you know, in a day or a week or even in, you know, a couple weeks. It's generally a couple month process. And so to go through the various parts, the first thing we do is Adelphi, and this year we did that on the 7th of October. Then the next thing we did was we compiled and reviewed the final fiscal year 2008 revenues. And we actually do that twice. We do that in the fall and then again in the spring because there's usually some adjustments to the actual revenues. And then on the 29th of October, we finalized our production forecast, and that's something that Dudley Platt does for us. On the 6th of November is when we finalized our oil price forecast for our fall forecast, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as well. On the 10th, we finalized our cost forecast, and as I said earlier, that's something new for us. We do our cost forecasting by a couple methods. We review plans of development. We look at costs worldwide. We look at what is submitted to us through our now monthly information forms, and we ask the companies what their best guess is on what they plan to spend in the next couple of years. So we do a number of things to get our cost forecast together, and we finally did that on the 10th of November. On the 11th, we finalized all unrestricted revenue forecasts, and then what we have to do after we do that is we create what we call a fiscal model. A fiscal model is basically takes our large forecasting model, and it sort of lops off a piece that we share with the Office of Management and Budget and with our Treasury Division and with the Permanent Fund Corporation. And what that fiscal model does is it incorporates all our revenue forecast variables and shows the couple-year period that we're forecasting. And then it, Treasury folks plug it into their budget model and their CBR model. And that makes the rounds more or less between some Treasury folks, the permanent fund folks, and folks at OMB, who then determine the investment levels and levels of the CBR and so forth based on that revenue forecast. And that takes a while to get everybody's input on that. So that's just one of the steps in the really pretty much 2 month long process. The next slide shows.
If you could just pause there for a minute. I'm quick sometimes, but I'm not that quick. We have any questions? Okay, Ms. Niehaus, is there anything different this year from previous years and how this process went forward and who was in attendance?
Yes, actually, this is my first forecast as the acting chief economist, and so there's a difference in personnel. For our fall forecast price session, we invited more people this year, and I was going to talk about that after the slide, but we did invite more people because we felt like the process was enhanced by having more interaction, more discussion. So we opened it up to other agencies, other interested folks. One thing we wanted to make sure that we did was that we had stakeholders involved in the process. In other words, people who had had a stake basically in what we ended up with on our price forecast. So what you saw at our Delphi is you saw a lot more folks from the Department of Revenue that never used to come. You saw a lot of more folks from the Department of Natural Resources. We always invite the legislative finance folks. We invite folks from OMB and the university. And this year we also invited a couple folks from the governor's office, although the one person that was going to come declined at the last minute. So we did open it up to more people than usual.
And who from the governor's office was invited and who participated?
Well, we opened it up to anybody that wanted to come, and we got a response from Anna Kim that she was going to come, and then sometime before it, she said she couldn't make it. So, but from Office of Management and Budget, John Boucher came. John participates in all our Delphi.
Maybe this is a question for better suited for the commissioner, but why do we go through a process that is so inclusive of all these different groups and not just use published reports and rely on outside experts that do this all the time, which is a kind of a different issue than I understand why we do our own production in-house and the production forecasts have been pretty accurate. But why do we do this process, and how do we keep the politics out of the forecast by doing it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think anybody that she mentioned that would be involved in this it would be considered part of a political process. But that aside, the method that is being discussed, and she'll get to it in more detail in two slides from where we are right now, but it's the process that's been used by the Department of Revenue for, as far as I know, about 10 years. Where it's based upon a forecasting methodology. This Delphi is a description of a process, a forecasting process where you basically bring in people who have a variety of views and you have them collectively or individually make their projections, and then collectively that reflects a broader spectrum of input. They as she'll describe, they use the published reports as part of their the basis for informing themselves before they would make their final individual projections. That said, the Delphi system has been the primary, almost exclusive methodology for making these forecasts. What you'll see is that this year we were uncomfortable with the results. They were significantly higher than the market at the time that we were, as you see in this timeline. What she'll show you is that at the time of the Delphi session, the oil price was almost twice what it was by the time we were having to finalize our departmental forecast. And so we ended up blending in other sources of reportable projections because some were more timely in terms of incorporating the events of the month of October and November than what was available at the time of the Delphi. And so our intent was to be as timely as possible in terms of the events of the day, but I would, I guess, assure you that there wasn't a political motivation to the process at all. It was strictly based upon the information that was available.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Commissioner, because I mean, this is, I think, kind of an important point and something that I have yet to understand. And it kind of arose when I first looked at these two pages, this page and the next page, and that's the timeliness issue. I mean, it seems to me that, and you can help me get beyond this perhaps, it just seems to me that other oil price forecasters are more flexible and rooted in their timelines don't seem to take as long, so they are able to come up with their forecasts much more quickly than is the state of Alaska. And so I guess the nub of the question is, why are we going through this process at the state level instead of just taking a blend of what other well-known oil price forecasters are saying? It just seems to me that if we had done that in these times, we would have been more ahead of the curve than we are right now.
Senator Elton, through the chair, if you actually allow us to go through about the next five or six slides, what we'll show you is that the issue isn't so much a matter of at the time that the forecast is being made, the information is stale. It's that at the time that we are basically, because of the lag isn't in when the information comes in to when the forecast is being made so much as in the established budgeting process, that the forecast needs to be made about a month before the revenue sources book and the governor's budget is rolled out. Now, what we're trying to do to address that very issue is during the legislative budget process, we are doing something that the department has previously not done, which is provide interim revenue forecasts. And those will be much more timely, as it were, with regard to the events of the day. Typically, the volatility is relatively minimal, and so we've been able to get by with two revenue forecasts per year. And it's been considered adequate for the budgetary process. This year, that is inadequate because of the volatility of market and the impact that it has on the revenue stream that is going to feed into your budget. And so we're responding to that by having a series of revenue forecast interim steps to feed into your process so that we overcome the issue that you just described.
If I could
go ahead, follow up.
And you may need to have a further discussion with me, or somebody from the department may need to, but it seems to me that we can get the same thing fairly accurately just by, you know, seeing what IEA is saying in their oil price forecasts, and it doesn't have to then be ground through your process, and it seems to me it would probably be quicker to do it that way than to have, you know, an analysis by the department that takes into account what IEA has already said.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I think you're diagnosing a problem differently. In other words, the issue with the what I believe is your concern is that the revenue forecast that came out in December seemed to be out of step with time. What you'll see through this process is that it wasn't the nature of the revenue forecasting process. It was the fact that because of the models that we have to use in order to go from a price to a revenue number, that takes time. And so at the date when we need to establish the price, what you'll see is that we were pretty much in line with AEA and all and the others. And it was that once you settle on the price, then you have to go through a whole series of steps before you actually get to the final revenue number that becomes public. And so this the perception that if we went to an off-the-shelf revenue forecast, that that would overcome the problem that you described is not accurate. We would be in the exact same place we were because we'd have to come up with a price on a particular date, and then the revenue number would come out at a later time. And so as you'll see, what we have done, I mean, what we can show you is the comparison of the Department of Revenue's price forecasting results methods compared to a variety of the published reports. And I think that, you know, it's really a matter of opinion in terms of the inherent value in having the Department of Revenue do an independent evaluation. I believe that it is appropriate because of the variety of views that are out there. AEA is just one, and AEA is as wrong, if not more wrong, than others that you might choose. I think that we have a fairly successful track record in comparison to other available revenue forecasts, and that we're not going to gain anything associated with the item that you described, this lag time, by pulling something off the shelf. And we would just be then dependent upon the, we would be subject to the biases associated with that individual forecasting tool. And so from the Department of Revenue's perspective, we, our methodology has been successful in the past. There isn't anything this year other than the volatility of the market that has caused it to call into question. In the future, if the volatility levels off, it will probably reestablish itself as the primary vehicle, and it's just a matter of the timing. We're being as timely as we can in coming up with a price forecast.
Mr. Commissioner, could you help us a little bit on 10.7 here on your chart? What was the price on 10.7?
If you can allow us to go about another five slides, we have actually charts that show you all of this, most of what we just discussed.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead and continue.
Okay, so on the part two of our forecasting timeline, just real quickly, our revenue forecast summary went to OMB for budget development on the 14th of November, and then it was time to start looking at preparing the revenue sources book. So we prepared the narrative and tables on the 18th, and then shortly after that, we released our fall forecast on the 9th. And the budget and the governor's budget was released on the 15th. So all that was actually, in my experience, probably the most compressed timeline I've ever operated under. As we'll see on the price forecast, we typically have it within a week of the Delphi. In this case, it was a month, and it had a lot to do with the price volatility. So the next slide shows that just what we talked about earlier, that our Delphi session is what we call a modified Delphi technique. It is, as I explained to you, we get everybody together and we discuss all the market forces that affect oil prices. On October 7th, on the 6 days leading up to our Delphi, the price oil price was averaging $92.85. And it had actually kind of gone up and down right around that time, so there was no consistency in price at that time. There was no clear direction which way it was going. As I described earlier, we expanded our list of invitees. We invited 50 people We ended up getting 29 plus. You know, we had folks that could come in for only part of the day, and some that, you know, that just visited and came in for the discussion. What we ended up with was 28 forecasts received. And when I say forecast, what we do is we ask everybody prior to the forecast session to give us their best guesstimate on oil price forecast, and then we have a session, and right after the session, we ask them to give us their final forecast. And so we received 28 of those, and what we ultimately used was the median of the forecast. And just so you know, if we were to add even one more forecast to that, you know, with the prices that people give us, one forecast hardly has an impact on the whole, on 28. You know, there were people, they were all over the place, to be honest with you. So we selected the median, and that's because we wanted to get rid of the outliers, people that thought the price was going to be way, way, way high, and people that thought the price was going to be way, way low. So, and just another thing is the Delphi in the past, as Pat said, was used a lot. In my years here under Dr. Michael Williams, we used the forecast, the Delphi, almost exclusively. This time, we recognized that we were in a period of extreme price volatility. And, you know, in the past, prior to Dr. Michael Williams, we've said that, you know, the Delphi was a tool. And so we looked to other forecasts as well. But I will get to that in a minute. Just moving on to the next slide.
If we could stop there for a minute. I didn't recall the numerics that I'd asked for in the slides. And there's the 92.85 when you started. I'd like to know what the numeric was when you handed it off on 11.12, 11.14. And then that would be the beginning of slide 9 or the ending of slide 8. And then what was, well, we know what the final outcome was. It's been published. But yep.
Mr. Chair, that actually will be shown on slide 14. We'll have a full chart that shows you exactly where it was on that date.
Right. Slide 14 doesn't have any dollar values on it other than on the axes. Do you have those numerics for me, or do you need just to get them to us later?
Mr. Chairman, I do have our Bloomberg daily prices. If you wanted to have me look at a certain day and time, I can do that.
11:13 will be fine. That's halfway between 11:12 and 11:14.
Sure. On 11:13, I show Bloomberg had a price WTI price of 58.24.
58.24. So that was your handoff price, according to your charts, to the Department of Revenue, Treasury, and so on and so forth. Is that fairly accurate?
Yes, or Mr. Chairman, but we actually settled on the price on the 6th of November.
On the 6th?
So we had to do some work in between the 6th of November and when we handed it off to.
And what was the price on the 6th of November?
6th of November, WTI was $60.77.
$50.77.
No, 60.77.
Okay, $60.77. Okay. Then you handed it off roughly at about 58.24, and then we'll get into the forecasted price at the end. I'm just trying to fill my chart in. But if you can go ahead and, if there's no other questions, you can go ahead and continue.
Sure.
Chairman?
Okay.
Hold it. We have a question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we, maybe we could fill in some of the other blanks since she's got it right before or something like that. The governor's budget released on 12/15, what was the price as of that date?
Yeah, we can do that. I was going to do that later. Go ahead and give us the, I'm going to look at slide 9. Go ahead and give us the price on 11. Well, give us the price on 11.14 so we match it up with our slide here. And this will just take a minute.
Okay. On 11.14, we show a WTI price of 57.04.
Mm-hmm. And then give us the price on the 9th of December.
4207.
And on December 15th?
4451.
And your last date on the slide is January 2nd.
February 2nd.
Excuse me, February 2nd.
Okay.
2-2.
February 2nd, 4008.
Does that answer, does that help, Senator Thomas?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead and continue, Ms. Niehaus.
Okay. So this slide just shows, one thing we do when we go to the Delphi session is we certainly look at other forecasts. We spend a significant amount of time towards the end of the day looking at what other folks forecast, and big ones in our view are the EIA, the IEA, and then there's also what we call the analyst average that's available through our Bloomberg terminals. And this slide just illustrates what forecasts were available to us when we went into our Delphi session, and as you can see, Goldman Sachs was the forecasting, and this would have been for the period of July through, well, it looks like it goes to April, June 2010. And through that whole time period, Goldman Sachs was up around 110 to 125. The EIA was saying even higher than that. Merrill Lynch was probably seeing the prices going down. The NYMEX, which is updated daily on the time we pulled it here, actually showed prices coming down and then leveling off and slowly climbing. So this is, we showed a slide similar to this at our Delphi session. This is part of our analysis and part of our forecasting, the way we forecast. We need to look at not just what we think things are, prices are going, but also what others are saying prices are going to. So the next slide shows we were actually, though, in a period of extreme oil price volatility, and that's we discussed that in our revenue sources book. There was and actually at the time of our revenue sources book, it hadn't even come down all the way down to the range that we saw it go to in December and January. So this just shows ENS and WTI crude prices, 86 through December 2008. It shows the big drop that we saw shortly after our Delphi and, down to December. And it's actually, if we were to extend this out, we'd see that it's starting to level off a little bit, but shows the huge decline, 80% decline in just 5 months. The next slide illustrates a little bit more about the oil price volatility, and what we did is here in our economic research group, we've looked at probably about 25, 30 years of prices, and we did a measure of volatility, basically took the standard deviation of the change from month to month, and found, based on this analysis, that probably two of the most volatile years in the history that we looked at were 1991 and 2008. And they're illustrated here on this chart. Basically, what we saw in 1991 is that you saw a huge, huge price drop with the first Gulf War. And it actually went up prior to January. It went up, and then it was very volatile in January and February and came down and leveled off actually throughout the year. And so on a calendar year snapshot basis, it had a high volatility range at the beginning of the year, but then settled down. In 2008, you don't see the same level of volatility, but what you do see is that it started out relatively not volatile, and then by about June, July, August, actually August is when it started to climb, and then it came down, it sort of leveled off. The volatility, again, this is just a measure of volatility, not price, but the volatility actually came down to a little bit more acceptable level right leading up to our Delphi. So you see in October, came down to about 4% based on this analysis, and then it started climbing again right after that till December. I think if you extended that out, you'd see the volatility coming down again. So This is just our kind of a look at the volatility and I guess the timing of everything. It was unfortunate for us that we timed our Delphi right at the time when things were right when they're on the precipice of being the most volatile in a long time. So, you know, it's bad luck, I guess. But so moving on to the next slide, looking again at the price forecast. Now, these were the price forecasts we had as of the date that we actually finalized our price forecast. And as I said earlier, we looked at the Delphi as a tool. The Delphi is basically a compilation of what people think the price is going to do, but then there's also other forecasts out there, and we recognize that. We look at them all the time. This was how the EIA forecasted as of November 6th, where the NYMEX was, which is coming down fairly level. This analyst median again is in a lighter green, Merrill Lynch in a darker green, Goldman Sachs in the magenta, and then Department of Revenue, what we landed on for our forecast in the fall. And I'll explain what that was in a minute. Go on to the next slide. This is just another...
Mr. Chair?
If you
can hold on for one second. I think this goes somewhat to Senator Elton's point earlier. What this reflects is if you take a snapshot on November 6th, on the day that we had to finalize our price forecast to then build it into what would become the revenue forecast that would come out a month later, these were the available other off-the-shelf, if you were, options in terms of forward-looking price forecasts. The number, just to be clear, the number that she gave you earlier was the price on each of those days. But this is looking at what were the expectations of those who follow the markets when you bring them back to that date, what were they looking at? And what you'll see is that Department of Revenue was significantly lower in our forecast on the day than where others were. Now, to be fair, EIA, they come out quarterly. And so it's not really fair to call them on November 6th and say, okay, where were you in relation to the information as of that day? Similarly, NYMEX, as we said, is the most timely. It's daily updated. The others are going to be updated at various times. And so what we were looking at is the trend. Everybody seemed to recognize the market was coming down. We were trying to anticipate not only where did we think the market was going, but also where were people in terms of their own expectations. And so we came in lower. Now, what you'll see as we go forward was that everything slid way down even past us. So by the time a month later when the revenue forecast comes out, we look like we're high compared to everybody else. So I just wanted to note that in terms of where we were on that day.
Yeah, just wave at me or give me a signal and I'll stop to whoever's speaking and then I'll call on you to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and continue, Ms. Niehaus.
Okay, so the next slide shows what our forecast actually ended up being, and it was a blend. Now I'll talk to that in the next slide. But this shows the actual price leading up to when we finalized our forecast, and you can see the price was pretty high up into that, and we showed actually a pretty significant decrease in price going out. One forecast that we incorporated was a low forecast that we prepared in the fall of 2007. If you look at that revenue sources book, you'll see that there is a high and a low scenario, and the low scenario in that actually it explained what the worst case scenario was at the time, which is, you know, the financial crisis spreads overseas, you know, supply is still staying high enough that it's not going to keep prices from going up, and demand falls off, and all sorts of horrible, horrible things happen, and then that's what the price would be. And so you see that's the pink line on this chart. And we did incorporate that into our price forecast. So the next slide actually illustrates what we started out with and what we ended up with. The Delphi median, as I explained earlier, you can see what folks forecasted. The first quarter was already done. But the second quarter, we were at about $90, $89 and $90, so pretty consistently in the $90 barrel range. And then it went on through fiscal year 10 at that same range. So our fiscal year 09 average was actually $96.76 when you take that first quarter into account. Fiscal year 10 was $90.50. As Pat said, we were uncomfortable with that. We saw that within the month that followed the price Delphi, it didn't seem realistic anymore. So we met and we gathered a couple other forecasts to look at. And we gathered the NYMEX on October 24th, and you see that in the next column. The column after that is the EIA forecast in October 2008. And then there's the DOR fall low scenario forecast that I just talked about earlier. So what we did is we took all four forecasts and equally weighted them, and that's how we came up with our forecast that we had. So the last column in that slide shows our official fall 2008 forecast and basically what the explanation behind it. The fall 2008 forecast for fiscal year 09, we only used NYMEX for that one because we thought that was the best near-term forecast. For fiscal year 10 was the equally weighted blend that I talked about. So that's basically how we ended up where we were for the fall revenue sources book.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
The next slide shows the same thing, just the ANS in nominal and real dollars. That's just our official price forecast. And just to revisit again, because we've heard so many folks say, you know, gee, we have all these analysts and, you know, they're so much more accurate than you guys. You know, there is a famous quote, if you must forecast, forecast often, which this slide actually kind of shows, because what you see on this slide is the x-axis says when these forecasts were made, and the red dots on them show where they forecasted what the price was going to be from January to March of 2009. And what you can see by the slide is that the analyst forecast kind of followed the price. The blue line is the price. So depending on when they made their forecast, it certainly influenced how much they forecast the price to be. So this slide shows that. It also shows our fall 2008 forecast in the, you know, low $60 range for that period of time. There's just one more slide, the next one, kind of the same sort of thing. These are all really, at the time, pretty recent forecasts, starting with October 1st, Economist Intelligence, got Merrill Lynch in there, UBS, and then our fall 2008 forecast in the 6th. And not to try and emphasize the point too much, but here's one more slide that shows entire calendar year 09 and where the other analysts' forecasts fit in with ours. You see where the black dotted line, we were pretty much in the middle.
Can I go ahead and continue?
Okay, so the next slide then shows our updated fiscal year 09 oil price forecast. That's the one that we came out with this week. We actually assembled it in January. Again, this process takes some time. So on January 20th, we pulled the NYMEX prices and because we believe that that was probably the best near-term forecast in the volatile markets that we have right now. So our January update was based on NYMEX prices, and they're shown here, and it shows the change from our fall forecast. And so when you see a fiscal year 09 average, keep in mind that that includes that first quarter, which is very high priced. You can see ANS was priced at $115.55. Our second quarter also has some actual prices in it, and then the third and fourth are strictly NYMEX. So we get a fiscal year 09 average for ANS of $63.28.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
Okay, so that's all I have on our price forecast. I'm going to move on to our cost forecast. And this is something new with the PPT again. We didn't have a whole lot of historical information to base our cost forecast on. We did receive, during the PPT, you'll recall there was a credit called the Transition Investment Credit, which said that companies would get a certain percentage of their cost leading up to the PPT as a credit. And so what we got out of that was we got reporting from what we believe are most, if not all, the companies of what they spent for the 5 years prior to PPT. So we had some history with that. We're developing some history as we go along on costs. So we're still learning how to forecast costs, but each passing month we get more information. So the next slide shows the lease expenditures as we were forecasting them in the fall forecast. Now we are going to be doing another forecast coming up here pretty soon. I've asked for adjusted expenditure forecasts from the companies that are producing oil on the North Slope or spending money anyway. And so I expect to get those soon, and I will incorporate them into our next forecast. You may have heard that companies are cutting back because the oil price is so low. So, you know, we expect that there's possibly going to be some adjustments in this forecast. But at least as of the fall, this is what we're looking at. Operating expenditures are staying relatively flat, increasing slightly. You see, capital expenditures make a pretty big bend in fiscal year 08. We're seeing that I believe companies are still expecting costs to be high. That's what I'm seeing when I get information from the companies. Our best guesstimate on how costs behave in relation to oil prices is that there's a 1 to 2 year lag. So perhaps we'll see those capital expenditures per barrel actually come down. But one thing you need to keep in mind when you're looking at this graph is that the capital expenditures lead up to production. They don't necessarily are not necessarily in line in timeline with the production. So when you see a capital expenditure per barrel figure, you got to keep in mind that that also includes future production. So the next slide actually shows the lease expenditures per barrel, again separated by operating and capital. And what you see is in fiscal year 07, a total of 1350 for operating and capital, a little higher in fiscal year 08, but you see some ramping up in 09 and 10, and the major portion of that is CapEx per barrel. So the important thing to realize, and at the same time you're seeing production going down, the important thing to realize is that capital that's being spent per barrel is actually going to be on future barrels, not necessarily the barrels that are being produced today.
Ms. Neat, if you could stop there for a minute on
sure.
The commissioner could help us on this one. The CapEx, the $3 billion, there's a 50% delay to take it against the state as a deduction. Could you explain to the committee how that works and how they should interpret these numbers? And then I'd like to know, excuse me, the date that the CapEx numbers were solidified and maybe a little more elaboration on how these are viewed with the changing market conditions.
Sure. These are our forecasts for the actual costs. When you build them into the revenue forecast, then you take into account the issue of 50% of the capital credits are allowable in the year that they're accrued, and the 50% have to lag a year. These numbers that we show you on this slide don't reflect that kind of lagging. These are just projections of the actual expenditures for those fiscal years. Then if you just refer back to the slide 8 where we showed you the schedule of developing the fall forecast, what you'll see is that we finalized the cost forecast on November 10th. And so these numbers reflect the information that was available at that time. As Sherry indicated, there's been public statements from companies indicating a expectation of reduced spending. We don't have any formal reflection of that, and so that will be something that we're gathering regularly. As Sherry said, we have various tools that we're using to try to estimate the expenditure levels, and our schedule is to update the cost estimates with our spring forecast. And so, as Sherry had indicated with the interim forecast, we're primarily re-looking at price as the primary variable that updates those numbers, and not doing a significant amount of change to the other variables. But I don't know if Sherry wants to add anything to what I just described in terms of the cost estimate process.
If I could, Mr. Commissioner, the one point of concern is when we have like an 09, roughly 2.4 rounded off to make the point. But if you've got a delay of 1.2 billion coming forward into 010, we have a price implosion. How does that affect just the flow of our net?
Well, Mr. Chair, the structural lag in the application of the credits to the revenue stream is already incorporated into our revenue forecast. I guess I'm not sure when you made a reference to a 1.2. Are you saying that half of that is lagged?
Well, I guess the point is, if you have a rapid increase in price that we had a year ago, a couple years ago, you're taking lower numbers, lower capital expenditures into an ever increasing price because the price is outrunning everything else. Now we're on the opposite side of the curve, where the price is diving like a submarine, and we're taking these delayed capital expenses and throwing it against a smaller revenue stream. Assuming I don't believe the $3 billion number is going to come out to be a realistic number in this marketplace. It may be, I don't know, but I'd be surprised if in this environment if that is a $700 million increase over 09, but we'll find out, I guess, at the end of 2010.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm not exactly sure what the nature of the question, but as I said, the forecast or the revenue number, the bottom line number that we provide you incorporates that, what I refer to as a structural lag in the application of the credit to our revenue forecast. I guess what that means is that that bottom line number is somewhat buffered from changes in expenditure levels on any particular year. Basically, the margin of difference between what we forecast from what we experience is only going to be felt, half the amount in any particular year, and then we'll incorporate it into our next because we'll have an actual. And that's actually, going back in the discussion of the justification for making that lag part of our process, it was to assist in our the rolling revenue forecast process, because what we'll have is each year we'll have
we can discuss it another time. We want to keep it moving. There's not it wasn't a question on the 50% leg. I think that's good policy from a state treasury perspective. We'll take the issue up. Maybe I can meet with you sometime and try to put a finer point on a garbled question.
Sounds good.
So we can keep the meeting moving. If you can please continue.
Okay, so the next slide then shows just the capital portion of the previous slide and gives a little bit of history. And again, we got the figures for 2000 through 2005 through information submitted via the PPT when we were asking for transition investment expenditures. So 2000 through 2005 shows basically that investment kind of went up in 2001, and we think that was mostly related to the development of Alpine. And then 2002 is coming down, but again, I think, you know, I think having investment credits do help, and perhaps also having high price helps. So as the price started to climb and investment credits were beginning to be part of our production tax system, you see that capital expenditures are climbing as well. And as far as the 09 and 10 number, you know, we're still learning about this. I think companies are still, you know, learning. I think, well, I don't want to say learning. I know that they have a lot more experience at it than we do, but they have, they're reporting to us what they think their costs are going to be. But they're in the same situation we are. They don't know which way the price of oil is going to go. So, you know, they're probably being conservative in what they're reporting to us on their expenditures and saying, well, we think they're going to be high. They very well likely could come down. So, you know, the $3 billion in fiscal year 10 may or may not happen. Maybe some of it depends on price. So moving on to then to the next slide, what we came out with this week as far as fiscal year 09 total revenue, it was basically a $1.2 billion difference from what we said in our fall forecast. Most of that is attributable to price. There's very little change in the way of production. And so what you see is you see most of it being experienced in the oil revenue side. So this slide shows unrestricted and restricted revenue. Unrestricted revenue is that which is available generally for legislative appropriation. Restricted revenue, this is restricted from the Department of Revenue's point of view. It might not be exactly the same as the financial statements would indicate, but as far as our view is, if you go on to the next slide, we consider as, we say that all revenue is classified as either restricted or unrestricted. And when we do our presentations, usually we tell you about unrestricted revenue, but what restricted revenue is the revenue that is restricted either by the Constitution, state or federal law, trust or debt restrictions, or customary practice. And as far as the customary practice goes, what we mean is that the legislature normally appropriates money back to various programs and things for the cost of running those programs. So even though the financial statements would probably not call that restricted revenue, we do just simply because it's customary practice to appropriate those back to the programs. And again, unrestricted revenue is what's available for general appropriation.
Ms. Niehaus, if we could stop there for a minute and back up to slide 26.
Sure.
Could we get an explanation on the investment earnings, the negative 6.9 in brief? I'm not asking for a detailed analysis at this time, but what's that number doing there?
Permanent fund. It's mostly the losses, the unrealized losses to the value of the permanent fund.
Constitutional budget reserve.
And the constitutional budget reserve. But that's why it's so large.
So those are unrealized losses, not realized.
Well, it's probably a combination. Part. Yeah, it's a combination of the two, but unrealized outstrips it significantly, outstrips the realized.
Okay, we'll save all that stuff for another day. But, okay, let's go ahead and if you could pick it back up, if there's Ms. Niehaus.
Okay, the next slide just shows sources of unrestricted revenue
point,
in oil.
Hold it, Ms. Niehaus. We do have a question from Senator Hoffman.
On that point of unrealized losses, what was the actual at December 30?
I defer to Jerry Burnett on that one.
Through the chair, this is Jerry Burnett, Department of Revenue, Deputy Commissioner. I don't have that with me, but we can get it to the committee.
Is it close to this figure? Well, I guess my question is it close to this figure, and do you anticipate positive earnings or negative earnings for the last 6 months?
Through the chair, we have no reason to believe that we will have negative earnings for the next 6 months. However, we didn't believe that we'd have negative earnings for the whole year either when we started. So
we'll provide you a breakdown on the difference between
where it is.
If you could, Mr. Commissioner, I think I've asked it through other channels,
right.
But if you could bring forward to the committee the December 31st balances We were curious yesterday on a slide on the CBR, but we're looking into that to make sure that that wasn't a misprint or the you know, some misinformation or what have you. There's no conspiracy issue or anything. It's just synchronizing up the data as we gather it. The balances of unrealized and realized gains and losses on the permanent fund, which is easy, and then the CBR as of December 31st, and then if you could also deliver at the same time the end of January, and please break down the subaccounts within the, for those at home, the CBR is broken into the main account and a subaccount, and if you could kind of give us a little breakdown. But we're going to go into the CBR at a later time in more detail, but it would be nice, we're going to, you know, to include that data layout in the answer. Go ahead, Senator, Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, just to be sure that we understand Senator Hoffman's question, I believe what I'm hearing is he's curious with regard to this being the FY 2009 forecast, and we're forecasting an investment loss on restricted revenue of $6.9 billion. I think his question goes to how much of that has been is based upon what we've experienced already, and how much is based upon what we're forecasting in the future, and that's what I we can bring back.
Correct, and then in that little other sub window in there, locking in or taking a look at the end of January's numbers, and I'm sure that the committee will be interested at the end of February to look at the closing day at the end of February and the end of March, so we stay. With timely information from a policy perspective of what's happening. We're not interested in the individual investment selections and so on and so forth at this table, but we are interested in the policy perspective. So we'll be asking you to bring that data forward.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'll bring it. So, Sherry, I believe we're on slide 28 on your packet.
Right. Okay. Slide 28, just a recap for what unrestricted revenue is made of. In oil, it's property tax, corporate income tax, production tax, that we call ACES now, and most of royalties, as you know, 25% of royalties are supposed to be deposited into the permanent fund. There was a slight change this year with HB 11. HB 11 is the bill that changed the amount of royalties back to 25% up until the dividend was impacted by a certain amount, that amount being $20 cumulative, and then HB 11 would be repealed. HB 11 was repealed based on this the dividend calculation in October of 2008, and so the royalties now to the permanent fund are back on the old formula, which has a distinction between when leases were issued, but basically the percentage went from 25% to somewhere in the 31 to 32% range. I can provide more backup information if anybody wants to know about HB 11 and how that impacts restricted revenue, but just as a little recap, that's what changed in October, so that is a change in fiscal year 09 revenue. We have what you'll see is a corresponding decrease in unrestricted revenue and an increase in restricted revenue.
I'm sure there's going to be...
Based on the royalties of the permanent fund.
Right. There's interest in dealing with that issue, bringing it on the table for a policy discussion, so we'll be working on that in the future.
Okay. And then other sources of unrestricted revenue, investment earnings on the general fund, and then, of course, the non-oil taxes, which include, non-oil revenues, which include taxes, charges for services, fines and forfeitures, and license and permits, rents and royalties, and miscellaneous. And I don't know if it was announced, but Dan Stickle is our non-oil economist, and he's there to answer any questions if anyone has anything about non-oil issues.
We have some questions, but we'll try to get through today's presentation so we can go on to the questions that we have at the end.
Sure.
Save him for later.
Dan spared.
Mm-hmm. If you can continue, Ms. Niehaus.
Okay, the next slide just shows then our fiscal year 09 revenue overview again. There's a dollar amount and the share of the total. You'll see that production tax is close to 50% of the total expected, and non-oil revenue makes up about 13%. So overall, you have about 87% of our unrestricted revenue coming from oil. The next slide shows a little non-oil detail. This is just all non-oil here. And of the non-oil revenue, the largest part comes from corporate income tax. Again, most of that, is related to oil, but in this case it's not. I'm sorry. Our corporate income tax here is non-oil revenues. Our mining license tax brings in about 6%. Our insurance premiums and tobacco, about 6%. Other taxes, 8.6%. So, and then investments are a significant amount of our non-oil revenue, and then other, which includes charges for services, fines and forfeitures, and so forth. Those all make up our non-oil revenue. Typically, our non-oil revenue has been, somewhere around 10 to 12, 13% of our annual unrestricted revenue. So moving on to the next slide, a comparison with our fall 08 forecast. Again, we see a total revenue reduction of about $1.2 billion. In that, the biggest hit was to the production tax, and that's because the production tax is driven on net profits, which net profits are driven off price and costs and things like that. So about 25% reduction in production tax. Corresponding decreases in royalty and corporate income tax. So overall, total revenue, 18.2% difference. Down below the key inputs again are price, which is the primary driver here. We have production going down very slightly, and then cost and investment staying the same for at least this fiscal year. And then in conclusion, what we saw in fiscal year 08 was record level oil price volatility. And it all kind of came, there was lots of volatility in the spring when we saw prices go up to $100 and up to $120, $130. That was, we believe that's an anomaly, just like what we're seeing now as far as volatility goes. So we had record oil price volatility both in the upward direction and in the downward direction. But I guess the message we'd like to convey is our forecast process is a long one. Unfortunately, our price forecast is one of the first steps in the process, and when we made our price forecast in the fall, we thought we were in the ballpark, and we did delay our price forecast a whole month to take into account new information. And then for our interim forecast, again, we recognized that oil prices were not as high as we thought they were going to be in the fall, and we reduced it for this forecast. Minimum production level changes from the previous forecast, again, about 3,000 barrels a day. And I guess one thing that we'd like to caution is that lower prices might impact future costs and possibly investment, and that's something that we'll be looking at in the next month or so is whether or not companies really are cutting back on their investment expenditures. And hopefully there will be corresponding decrease in costs. We saw costs run up due to oil price. Maybe costs, we like to see costs come down due to oil price. So, there could be changes on the horizon for that. And then I just have one more slide. When we testified in House Finance, Representative Hawker wanted us to talk a little bit about a change that we made in the fall book from basically these are counting terms, but going from what we call a cash basis to accrual basis accounting. And essentially what happens is, as long as I've been here and as long as I've looked back in history, the forecasting has always been done on a cash basis. And what I mean by that is that we recognize revenues when they're received, as opposed to accrual basis, which is recognizing revenues when they are earned. And so when you have a change between months from, or between fiscal years, a June production month generates revenue that's received in July. The Economic Research Group has always recognized that June production month revenue as the next fiscal year's revenue, in other words, starting with July. This year, we were wrapping up our fiscal year 08 revenues, what we knew them to be, and we were anticipating that June revenues received in July were part of fiscal year 09. June revenues were extraordinarily high by any measure in the state's revenue history. We took in about $1.2 billion, and that was because of the high oil price primarily, and also production was pretty high. So $1.2 billion in 1 month, all of a sudden, based on accounting records, went from July back to June. And we discovered this just prior to our fall forecast that partly because of the way the budget in for fiscal year 8 was set up, that excess revenues, what I understand, were going to the CBR, having that revenue in fiscal year 08 rather than fiscal year 09 was kind of a big deal. So I took this information to the commissioner and to Jerry Burnett, and we discussed the right way to go about things, and we decided that in order to be in line with the rest of the state's financial documents and budgeting process, that we needed to make a change to our forecasting. So what we did is we changed to more coincide with the rest of the state, and now we consider June production part of the prior fiscal year. So the $1.2 billion that we received in July for June is part of fiscal year 08. And what this did essentially, as far as the revenue sources book goes, is the shift in the fiscal year did affect historical price and production. What it did not affect is historical revenue, and the reason for that is because for our historical revenues, we've always looked to the state accounting system, which has always done things on an accrual basis. So we think that overall this change was good. It unfortunately apparently rattled some people because they saw a slightly different number. But we think that being in line with the remainder of the state's efforts as far as financial information is a good thing. And partly it's driven by the fact that our current production tax system has such a significant progressivity feature that when prices are high, really drives up revenues quite significantly. So that fact, that and just wanting to be more in alignment was the determining factor in making this change. And what you'll see is as we go through the months, if you have price volatility, you're going to have significant revenue volatility as well. So we just thought that this was an important change to make, and so we did it with our fall forecast.
Okay, thank you for your presentation. Mr. Commissioner, why was it done this year versus not done last year? That's not real clear to me on the issue of the adjustment. I understand trying to link everything with the CAFR so you know all the documents line up and it actually in the long run makes less confusion. And then help me with my recollection with the revenue source book on numerics restated in there and is there a proper disclosure or a flag in it to notify people that there was a change from previous editions. So 5 years from now when we pick up the old documents, that some of us actually look back at some of the old documents, it'll help us with our memory as it fades.
Certainly. Answer to the first question with regard to why this year, the answer is that it wasn't an issue that actually raised its head until this year. The department had always done it, as far as we're aware, along the cash basis. It was seen as keeping things consistent from one revenue projection to the next, and the deviation each year between what the revenue forecast or the revenue report had shown and what the CAFR ended up showing. The CAFR is our annual financial statement that is done basically to through the accounting system to show where all the money came and went. And so the difference between the Department of Revenue's numbers and the CAFR was not seen as significant. It was just sort of within the margin of error of people's expectation, and it just sort of was the way the business provided. This year, as Sherry indicated, when we got into fall, two different things really were drivers. One was, as she noted, the effect of June, that basically June of 2008, the revenue for that month was so significantly different than June of 2007 that it caused there to be a much wider disparity between what Department of Revenue would say was the FY 2008 revenue and what the CAFR would say. And so that was one thing that just sort of was a much brighter distinction. Secondly, the way that the FY 2008 budget was structured, there were certain spillover effects associated with the amount of available funds. And so the amount that would end up in the constitutional budget reserve, how the statutory budget reserve would be funded, all were dependent upon these numbers. And so there would be a much more distinct disconnect in terms of the flow of funds between the Department of Revenue and the CAFR if we did not recognize this. And so it was, as she said, it was brought to my attention. It was the first time I was aware of this distinction, and I made the call to do the switch now and to reflect it in our fall 2008 revenue book. And then it became a question of, okay, so how does that then affect the way that we show historical numbers? And as Sherry indicated, the actual revenue numbers, the way the Department of Revenue has done it, is that we would take the CAFR number for the past actual revenue, but we would keep our production and price numbers. So I guess one way of looking at it is that our historical numbers have never completely added up. Once you get a year lag, they didn't reflect each other. But we fixed that through this methodology, because now we have the same months being reflected as the production and price as the revenue. As far as final question, that was a question that came up, and I'm not sure what the answer. How is it reflected in here, Jerry, compared in terms of noting the change that was made?
I have to look, but I think Sherry could answer that question.
Ms. Niehaus, could you help us with that, how it's footnoted in the fall forecast to help us keep things straight as time goes on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There is a footnote in our appendix tables that essentially says in FY08 the Department of Revenue made a change in the method by which it accounts for future revenues as well as historical and future production and oil prices from a cash basis to an accrual basis. And then we need to explain that this method will better align fiscal year revenues with the state's financial reports and other publications.
Okay. That,
as a result, slight modifications have been made.
That's fine. We don't have to read the whole book. And I see the commissioner, and thank you, Ms. Niehaus, for the information. The commissioner does have the page.
It's page 116, and it's footnote number 1.
Okay.
And I think the question, maybe, if you had, will be, do we continue to reflect this footnote in subsequent revenue sources books? And from what you describe in terms of those who are interested in going back and comparing them, it may be beneficial for us to do so, it sounds to me. So we'll reflect that in our production of future revenue sources.
Because there is different concentrations in the different revenue source books in different areas, so by going back and reviewing those, there is a lot of good information in them. Is there any other questions on the presentation from the committee? Because there's a couple other items we want to hit on today, and we got about 12 minutes left. Senator Thomas.
Just one minor one, or at least a couple, and one is the motor fuels tax on page 30, and I remember the action to suspend it. Is there part of it still in existence, and I just overlooked, or what is that?
through the chair, Representative Thomas, what you'll find is that the motor fuel tax was not suspended at July 1. It's suspended the I think it's September 1 or some other time. So you have a part of this year where of FY09 where you're collecting motor fuel tax, and you have a part of, and most of FY10 you're collecting motor fuel tax, but not all of FY10. So you'll have a partial year in each of those years.
Okay, thank you.
And then we'll expect an updated FY10 price on what date, Mr. Commissioner?
The FY 2010 revenue, for the interim revenue forecast, is expected to be released, I think it's February 15th?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it
18th? Yes.
18th, February 18th. Okay. And that will include a new price forecast as part of it.
Yes, and we'll be asking about that and then the capital cost. And do you have a question before we jump to the next issue?
Please.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It has to do with the forecast. The budget for 2010 was based on $74 and some pennies, right?
Right.
And then I guess some people sort of smirked at that number and said, you know, it's pie in the sky, but be that as it may. But shortly thereafter, some people in administration started using the number $71. Where did the 71 come from?
The $71 price was the governor's FY 2010 budget basically had expenditures that were, it was like $375 million less than the revenue forecast. That the revenue forecast was based on the $74 price. The governor's budget spent less than that. The $71 price was an approximation of what the price, the average price would be to basically balance the governor's budget. And so if you remember the governor's budget, because it expended less than what the fall forecast was, included a surplus amount. So the $71 price was seen as, it was an approximation of the average price that would be needed to meet the governor's budget expenditures.
Okay, and thank you. And just this is a wild card, and I'll ask it because many Alaskans asked me, PFD this coming year, and the principle and all the rules. Should we have a low expectation or no expectation?
I'll answer it twofold. There's been talk with regard to.
Quickly, if you could.
Okay.
We've got other subjects we're going to hit on today.
I guess as far we believe, or our position is that the permanent fund dividend is entirely safe in terms of actually being able to provide a dividend. The amount of the dividend is based upon a 5-year rolling average of returns. Given that it's a 5-year rolling average, you just basically are going to compare this year to 5 years ago. What falls off? What drop? What comes on? And so it'll be a very healthy number in the historical perspective of permanent fund dividends, and it will come down slowly even if we sustain the type of market that we're in.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and we're just trying to get us out of here as close to 11 o'clock as possible, but we do want to hit on two more quick topics, and we'll be bringing the commissioner back on the CBR and some other policy issues, and when that subject comes up, we'd appreciate the commissioner himself to be here because of the magnitude of the policy discussion. I think it's only applicable for the commissioner to be here in person. Oil and tax credits in the governor's supplemental. We want to talk on that about $200 million, and then we want to talk a little briefly on your unallocated reduction. But first, we want to talk about the $200 million. And can you explain how the $200 million is embedded within the budgetary process, and is it not an offset to revenue?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The tax credit program affects the state's budget in two ways. The bulk of the credits are basically off budget. You won't see them because they merely on the payments that we receive from the oil companies, they will reduce their amount owed by the amount of the credit. And so it'll just be in the form of lower receipts that we would receive. And so that Those credits are basically factored into the revenue projection, and we basically lower the revenue projection based upon our expectation of how many credits are going to be offsetting the production and price derived amounts. What does end up in the budget are the amount of credits that are going to be accrued by companies that don't have production sufficient to offset those. And for those, we will cut a check and send them the amount of the credit. And therefore, it becomes an expenditure and has to be reflected in the budget. So within the large subset, as when Sherry showed you the numbers of our projections of capital and operating expenditures, you take that and you take a subset of that, which would be the capital expenditures for non-producers, and of those, we expect then to have to pay an actual payment to them. Then it becomes a question of timing. When are we going to have to make that payment? We show our projections in terms of costs in the year in which they're accrued. But when they then filter into the budget, it's a question of when are we going to actually have to make the payment. What we had anticipated was the system would be much faster, that the companies would submit for the credits much quicker, that the time frame for reviewing their applications and auditing their cost reports would be much quicker. And in reality, the lag time has been greater than what we had originally anticipated. And so what we're finding is, although the expenditures we believe are being made at the levels that we, around what we had expected, that the time frame in which we actually have to cut the check is a much wider range. And so what we're experiencing now is that for FY 2009, what we had anticipated in terms of the amount of the checks we're going to have to cut for these non-producers is less than what we had budgeted, and therefore it affects the amount in the budget that shows up as that line item.
Senator Hoppen has a question, but before he asks his question, I just want to let the committee know that I did queue up the commissioner before the meeting that we'd be asking him this question along with the set of questions coming up after this subject matter. So he had a little time to think about his response. Senator Hoffman, and then Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it seems to go back to the last presentation that you had, whether the expenditures are going to be considered cash, which it seems as though that's the way you're going, but it seems to be, to me, that it should be an accrual. So we should just accrue the expense and then pay it at a later time. So on one hand, when we're talking about production and price changes, you're going from a cash to an accrual. But in this particular instance, we're going from an accrual to cash because we're not paying it. But it seems as though we should book it as a payable and realize those expenditures on an accrual basis. So I think we should be consistent and possibly accrue those expenditures and pay them when they're due.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to focus in just a little bit on the timing component. And you talked about that lag time between applications and when the credit would be payable. I mean, is that timing complicated by the fact that you don't have audit resources? Is it a delay in applications by the companies? Is it something else that we need to take a look at?
I think it's a combination of a number of things, and I am not aware of anybody within that section indicating that it is a lack of resources. I believe that you can attribute it to a number of different factors. One, timing of both the companies and the state personnel learning or establishing a process that hadn't existed previously. What's the nature of information exchange? What's the type of information that's needed, generating the forms that are needed, and so forth? It's the ramp up to get a new program off the ground that's fairly complicated in terms of the amount of information that needs to be shared. And so it's both a matter of having the companies have a clear process, but also us learning how long it takes for these companies to generate information when we both seek it initially and when we seek clarifications. And so I think at this point, and I'll continue to press my staff on it, I'm not aware of it being a matter of the state having limited resources and that delaying the process. I think it's a matter of just having a better sense of a new process, how long, what's a realistic expectation of the time frame it takes to get through all of the paperwork and evaluation and so forth that's normally associated with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to go back to Senator Hoffman's point of cash versus accrual and how creative on occasions things may become. We always want to be a little careful of that. Could you help us by bringing back some data on this or with the other departments so we can see a timeline of when these credits, maybe by quarter or whatever facilitates the information flow that's not so aggregated, it's meaningless. So we could get a good understanding of the issues that Senator Hoffman has brought up. Also, this credit hasn't been in place very long, so we can go back to the beginning and take a look at it. Our concern that some of us have is we have a 2010 budget, and we have a bigger hole coming at us most likely than in 2010 than what we're going to try to deal with here in 09. And we want to make sure that we're all on the same page in what we're dealing with, so there's no misunderstanding and we can focus our attention on the policy discussion.
Mr. Chairman, we'll bring you that information. And I think just to note, this issue, I guess to answer two different questions, in terms of the impacts of FY 2010, the just thinking about it conceptually, the issue isn't so much if we're going to recognize that some of the previously anticipated FY 2009 payments are not going to have to be made until 2010. That only becomes an issue if what we had anticipated for 2010 remains in 2010. If this is established as basically the process has to, the spring has to be stretched out longer, what we had previously anticipated for 2010 is going to roll over to 11. And it's not going to be an aggregate on one particular year. It's just going to be that we have to spread it out over a further period of time, spread it over the bread thinner.
We'll give you the opportunity to bring forth the data and we'll have the discussion at the table. Because it is a concern, it's the major component within the supplemental budget, and we have some interest in it.
And we share your interest. I mean, it's something that we're working on and trying to come to grips with. And I think I'd be remiss if I didn't note that it was an issue a year ago that we suddenly had to add these expenditures in, and the budget from comparing 2007 to 2008 suddenly looked like it had grown when it was just an addition of these credits.
And Senator Hoffman has the next item up on the unallocated. Do you want to?
Yeah. Howard, the governor has come up with her position on unallocated reductions. How is your department going to handle the unallocated reductions?
Yeah, we've,
it seems to me that if we're going to set a policy, we need to know where they go instead of handing a blank negative check to you and you decide where you want cuts. We may not agree with those, so I was wondering if I might get some idea of what your process might be if we decided to take that avenue that was suggested by the governor's office.
And I have one more little addition on to his question, if I could, and it's $390 million for your department. I was given the subcommittee duty by $390,000.
I was going to say, wow.
What did I say, $390 million or something?
Yeah.
$390,000. Senator Hoffman last year in your budget, so was I. neglect did not whacken you $390,000 last year because you're just overly fat, or what do you? I'd like to know the list in your pocket of what you're going to do.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just giving a brief history, and just to note, the Department of Revenue were involved in a lot of the hot button issues, but when you get down to our budget, it's relatively boring. It's a fairly low budget, and there aren't a lot of big ticket items in there. But when it comes to this particular issue, the sequence was with the governor's signing of the FY 2009 budget. She directed the departments with this unallocated cut. And so we built that into our budget plan primarily by not filling some positions that were vacant and building that into our budgeting process. That was the nature of the savings of the $290,000. That is now being incorporated, and Jerry, as the former Admin Services Director, can go into more detail about how that was worked into the process.
But just a point of clarification, so I'm understanding it correctly, you're saying under the signing of the 09 budget last June or so, when that took off, the governor, your boss, asked you to shave some numeric off at $390,000 or some other number. And then you set forth that internal process to identify that. So then there is no response from your department or the administration with the collapse in the oil price in the fall? This was all set up last summer?
Mr. Chair, this particular cut was decided as a restriction in our budget when the governor signed the budget. And in fact, we took action and delayed hiring of positions as the commissioner and restricted that much money in the accounting system in the personal services line. And that savings has already occurred in our budget.
This is going to be an interesting conversation, Senator Hoffman.
Well, the problem that I have is that, you know, we're setting policy and we know what the citizens expect of the operating budget. But if we leave and give departments the ability to cut $20 million worth of services, we don't know where they might be. And I, as a budget policymaker, am reluctant to do that because it doesn't say where the administration's priorities are. So unless I have an indication that of where those might be, my position would be not to give that allocation. And the department, my question to the department is, will they still try to proceed in reducing the budget in certain areas that we as policymakers don't want reduced? Because we've authorized that budget, the governor has already signed that budget into law, so we as policymakers expect those services to be delivered. So I guess the question is, if we decide not to authorize the $20 million and whatever your allocation may be, what would you do?
Senator Hoffman, to the chair, and I explained to the chairman that we're venturing into areas that are not my direct responsibility, so I'm going to walk into this conversation a little bit gingerly. But I guess from my view of the relationship between the legislative budgetary process and the governor's role, I fully recognize that you're setting priorities and you're establishing the authorization for expenditures. But I believe that it is also incumbent on the governor to exercise some discretion in terms of whether she's actually going to spend all of that in all of those areas. And she's going to have to be answerable to you when some of those are not expended and whether or not priority services are not being provided. That's part of the give and take between the two branches of government. Now, when she authorized the budget, signed it, and then directed us to look for, say, additional savings, I think that was part of her role in the process, and we have to come before you and explain to you how we exercised that cut. and that's what we're doing.
Keep control of the dots. I'm going to just get to you in just a second. What was the dollar amount that was asked for the Department of Revenue's budget reduction after the signing?
Mr. Chair, it was $390,000.
$390,000. $390,000 is the same number sitting in front of me for the supplemental. And you're telling us that those savings have already taken place. You've implemented that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Well, I would beg to differ, because if the governor doesn't want to provide services that we proposed in an operating budget, her decision is made when she can veto portions of that operating budget. Because if she vetoes those portions, we as a legislature have the opportunity to override those budget cuts. So if she signs them into law, I believe that she's obligated to provide those services. Because where is our policy powers lie in saying, no, we are the policymakers? You know, if we want DMV open 8 hours a day for 5 days a week, she's not going to close those doors, because we said that's what's going to happen. If she wants to say that they're going to be closed on Mondays, she vetoes that item and closes those doors, and we say no. We go through the process and override her and put those dollars back in. Where is our policy to add those dollars back in if you're saying that she can... after she signs that budget, she can go ahead and make additional cuts.
Senator Elton.
I don't see that.
Is there a question, Senator Hoffman?
I don't see that that's there, and I wonder if that's what you believe to be the process.
Mr. Commissioner.
Senator Hoffman, to the chair. Again, I'm not trying to establish the administration's position on this. I'm not in a position to get into a legal argument about the separation of powers issues, but I do think that there is a distinction between the governor and the director of the Department of Motor or Division of Motor Vehicles deciding what hours they're going to stay open and how much it's going to cost. I don't think that the budget necessarily establishes what the hours of operation for a particular office is going to be. But there is a line there I clearly recognize in terms of what is the legislative prerogative in terms of establishing the priorities of the state and what's the executive prerogative in terms of executing that. But in this particular instance, I think that the line is being drawn a little bit thin.
Senator Elton.
Well, I appreciate the conversation, because I think it's an important conversation. So I have a couple of questions. You mentioned that you began implementing the savings soon after the governor signed the budget. Have you presented to the chairs of the committee or budget subcommittee chairs where the $390,000 worth of savings have occurred in the department?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, we have not yet met with our subcommittee chairs in either the House or the Senate to discuss our budget.
That's not the question, and maybe I asked it a little bit inartfully. You made these decisions last summer. I mean, has there been any attempt in the ensuing months to let the committees, the relevant committees, know what you weren't doing that was anticipated in the budget that was passed by the legislature?
In particular, to the two operating co-chairs?
Well, first answer the underlying question, which is there something that we're not doing in terms of actual public services or services the department is providing? And to the best of my knowledge, we have not changed the level of service that we're providing. We're basically asking our folks to pick up more of their individual responsibilities, because we're not filling various positions. The fact that we have chosen within our department, and all I can speak to is our department, that we have chosen to exercise the governor's request through a means of reducing our personal service costs meant that we can still provide the same level of service that we were anticipating. We're just stressing our system a little bit more than what would otherwise have been expected.
Mr. Chair, I guess then the question becomes more complicated. I mean, if you've made a decision that you didn't need $390,000, but you can still deliver the same public services, that's not a good answer, and I think it requires additional information from the department, because you either made a mistake when you were discussing with the legislature last year, you either made a $390,000 mistake. Other departments may have made a $1 million mistake, according to the unallocated cuts that were being made in those departments. And so I'm not any more satisfied with that answer than I was with the previous answer.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I accept that. All I can describe for you is the decisions that are made within the Department of Revenue related to that, and you'll have to talk to the other departments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We're just pretty much, is there another question on this? We'll take it up at a later date, but Senator Huggins.
Well, it has to do with the hiring freeze, which is a different subject, but could be a very quick question to answer.
Well, go ahead.
The auditors have always been important in your organization. Number one, how many auditors are you short? Number two, what is the guidance to you in the freeze on hiring as it applies to your department?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, the auditors issue, the auditors are a key component of our department, and we were successful in bringing on the master auditors that were the topic of the discussion during the ACES session, and we have been able to hire those. With regard to additional audit, I'm not up to speed on if there's any current openings, but the direction that's provided by the governor's office with regard to the hiring freeze allows for exceptions if we justify a position as being essential for the purposes that are provided in the governor's direction. And at this point in time, I've not been provided with information from my department, particularly the tax division that has the auditors, that there is a vacant position in which we have an essential need to fill it. But if that were to come to me that there is an audit position which is a critical position that needs to be filled, then we would pursue that through the governor's waiver program.
Senator Huggins?
Just a quick follow-up. So in your budget request that we're fixing to be reviewing, are there any new personnel positions? Request.
To the chair, Senator Huggins, I don't believe that we have any in the operating budget for the Department of Revenue that are new positions at this point.
Thank you.
Just kind of in closing, this is the last subject matter of the meeting today, and we are over, and I apologize for the interest in the committee at subject matter at hand. So the committee has some questions on the $200 million, the viability of using that, and $200 million in the oil tax credit. There's interest in the 50, and I know you're not the OMB director, but I'm sure she's watching, or will be shortly, I'm sure, on a replay. There's 50 50 million that was put in as a holding number in the Excel spreadsheet for the supplemental that we now have in front of us last spring. So that's $250 million. Then we've got the unallocated expenses, and from what I'm hearing from you folks today, have already taken place. And then there's new spending in here, and these are just summary numbers, new spending in here of $38.3 million. One of the things I think the committee needs to find out, if they've already done the unallocated reductions, have they already done the new spending in the GF, and I think that's some of the things that we need to explore as we walk down that road. And you have a quick comment, Mr. Commissioner?
Just for a point of clarification, you mentioned that the unallocated cut has already been achieved, or I'm not sure how you put it, but the unallocated cut was built into our budget when it was directed by the governor, which means that it will be basically achieved over the course of the entire fiscal year. It's not that it has already been achieved for the first 8 months of the fiscal year that we've arriving already.
We'll sort this out with OMB and so we understand what's going on. And then I'm sure we'll have a discussion between the four co-chairs and the two finance committees on what kind of response the 09 budget should or shouldn't have for the revenue differences between what was anticipated in June and what was anticipated 6 months later, which we spent 2 hours talking about earlier today. There's this a different paradigm in the world relative to oil revenue. So we've probably created more questions today than we have answered. But this little, we're gonna reconvene tomorrow at 9 a.m. Tomorrow we're gonna have a discussion on our budget reserves and our savings accounts by Ledge Finance. We're working on that presentation. Also legislative finance, the Division of Finance from Department of Revenue, or excuse me, Department of Administration, will give a refresher on sweep mechanics, technically probably kind of dry, important that we understand how the sweep mechanics work. We're going to work on the general fund and the constitutional budget reserve, the sweep mechanisms. And then we're going to try to understand how the state books are closed at the end of each year as far as the timing, the calendar timing, and the fiscal year timing, and the cash flow timing, and how things are balanced. So we kind of put this kind of package together. We will be coming back and talking about in the future here shortly the permanent fund and its status, the PERS and TERS portfolios and their status, along with the CBR and the SBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve, for those watching at home, which takes a three-quarter vote, and the Statutory Budget Reserve, which is a simple majority vote of the legislature to access. We're going to talk about those. But when we talk about those policies, recognize that Commissioner of Revenue, Mr. Galvin, is on the board of the Permanent Fund as a representative. Certainly has an interest in the PERS and TERS.
I'm also on the ARM board.
Right, on the ARM board. And then the CBR. So we need you here on that meeting date in smiley form as we walk through the overview and then talk about some of the policy, the policies that we're struggling with concerning those. You've got a personal invitation from the two co-chairs and the rest of the Finance Committee. This meeting is adjourned.